All right, well, welcome from a nice long weekend. Beautiful weather. Felt like spring yesterday. 59 degrees. Grass is growing. Okay, so this morning we have Dan Stonington, who serves as the Cascade Land Conservancy's Conservation Policy Director, and he's responsible for policy development for rural lands, conservation finance, and ecosystem service markets. And prior to joining the Cascade Land Conservancy in November 2006, he worked for 3 years as an environmental consultant for Ross & Associates in Seattle. He has a bachelor's degree from the University of Washington and a master's from the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. And he's a member of the High Country News Board of Directors. And today he's going to tell us about the Cascade Agenda, an upland strategy for saving Puget Sound. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks for the introduction. Thanks for having me here today. So, as Bob just mentioned, I'm going to talk about the Cascade Agenda and talk about the upland side of water quality in Puget Sound. Just a quick additional introduction. Cascade Land Conservancy, as Bob mentioned, I'm the Conservation Policy Director for Cascade Land Conservancy. So I work on rural lands policy, do some lobbying at the federal and the state level for finance mechanisms that are related to conservation, for ecosystem markets. And Cascade Land Conservancy has been around for about 20 years. We have offices in these five counties, although our Mason County office, which is furthest on the left, actually has activities all over the Olympic Peninsula. We've conserved about 150,000 acres over the last 20 years and are Washington's largest independent land trust. So that is who I am and where I'm coming from today. The quick overview of what I'd like to do for today's seminar is start with some of the growth trends that sort of shape what's happening in terms of change in growth in urban, suburban, exurban areas around Puget Sound. Talk about how that relates to Puget Sound. And then talk about the Cascade Agenda, which is the strategy that Cascade Land Conservancy and a number of other organizations have put together to address this growth, to capture it, channel it into good conservation and good development, and then give you guys a little bit of the latest from sort of what's hot in the state capitol, what's hot in Congress that we're paying attention to, and in terms of efforts to really make this growth challenge work to our advantage. So starting out with growth trends. These are some charts from the Puget Sound Regional Council, which is the Council of Governments for the central Puget Sound area. And the basic gist here is that even though we've had the economic downturn, even though there's been some changes the last, you know, sort of year or two in terms of home building growth, that kind of thing, the population growth still is increasing. If you look at climate change models and sort of climate refugee modeling, this is likely to be a place where people are going to continue moving even more from those sorts of forces. So we've been growing. We're going to keep growing. There's a lot of people coming to the region. If you look out 100 years past the plan that Puget Sound Regional Council has, the numbers start to get really big. 15 new Seattles in the Puget Sound Basin. And so the question's really, what impact does that have on Puget Sound? What impact does that have on our ability to not only maintain the salmon habitat and the water quality we have now, but to actually improve it and restore and get back some of what we've lost already. So that's kind of this fundamental challenge that drives a lot of what we do at Cascade Land Conservancy and also what we do in respect to how we're trying to be a partner in the Puget Sound restoration efforts. The Puget Sound Partnership, right at the end of 2008, so just a little more than a year ago, came out with their action agenda. And priority A1 in the action agenda is protect intact ecosystems. And reading a little bit more into the detail of what they're talking about, it's essentially protecting Puget Sound by making the upland, by making the land side of the equation work. So it's focusing the growth into urban areas. It's protecting the intact ecosystems and the intact habitat that we do have now. Putting conservation easements on land, making it possible to go in and restore the areas that have been damaged. So in a way, this is actually most of what I'll say directly about Puget Sound today is just that there is this acknowledgement and really widespread agreement that you got to fix the upland, the sort of land use, really confront that challenge of growth if you're going to have a hope at saving Puget Sound. So in terms of talking about the Cascade Agenda, some of our strategies to conserve the working forests and rural landscapes that are sort of threatened with development, it's all within the context that we got to figure out the land use if we're going to succeed at Puget Sound. So I have a quick question for our organizers, just in the context of what I just said. Do you know if I can play a video?
We haven't done it.
They said this would be charting new territory. Okay, I'm just going to take a risk to see if this is possible.
You might have to.
Okay, let me just try this. There's no sound associated with it, so if
that's
this works.
That's his video there, but I don't know whether that's a... Give it a try.
Okay, vindicate. This seems a little bit complicated. Validate your copy of Windows. Okay, abort that mission. We'll...
Yeah, it says video there, but I don't know.
That probably... Okay, we won't mess with it.
All right.
So this... the video, we've been doing a set of just sort of whiteboard animation videos, and the basics of the video is land use is related to Puget Sound, and the message is that it's sort of a no-brainer because whatever you dump upstream, uplands flows down into the sound. So there I spared you the video and captured it in 5 seconds or less. So I want to just keep talking a little bit about some of the growth that's coming to the region. These are some numbers that came out about a year ago. And the message here is that if our growth strategy, which is a plan that's put together by the Puget Sound Regional Council, if the growth strategy was hitting the numbers right on the money, then all these bars would be at the red dotted line. So this is to say, how does our growth compare to the targets that we've set and the goals that we've set in the growth strategy? And the goals that we've set is that most of the growth should go into the bigger urban centers, the metro cities, the core cities, the larger cities. These are all sort of have specific definitions in this plan. And that we should minimize growth going to the rural areas. We shouldn't have any growth going to the resource areas, which are designated farmland and forest land of long-term commercial significance. And the problem with the numbers that came out a year ago is that basically it's the opposite of that. So we're having a lot less growth than we wanted going into the urban areas, a lot more growth than we thought was going to happen in the smaller suburban cities, the cities that are sort of out on the fringe of the metropolitan area, and in the rural areas. We planned for about 20,000 folks into the rural areas in King, Pierce, Snohomish, and Kitsap County, and there was about 45,000, so over twice that. So these are 5 and 10 acre lots. These are places where you're really dramatically changing what once was forested areas or farmland, and what's the impact that has on Puget Sound. That's a real concern. A couple of images here that show what it looks like when we succeed at different levels in terms of our growth planning. So this is out east of Marysville in Snohomish County. And in some places, the urban growth boundary, the growth management line essentially, has functioned pretty well. And you can see a pretty clear distinction between what you'd call rural and what you would call urban. And then in other areas, there's a lot less of a distinction. There's a variety of reasons for this, but the message simply being that, you know, we're succeeding in some ways, but in a lot of ways, we're still really having challenges managing the growth and getting it to focus into the urban areas. So I want to give a couple other examples just of what this pressure is doing. There's two properties circled on the screen here. One is an example of forest land that has converted recently to development. Another is one that likely will in the future. So bottom left hand of the screen is down on the Pierce County Thurston border. And zooming in on that, it's right near the Nisqually River. This is just to the west of Mount Rainier National Park. If you've ever gone to Paradise up at Mount Rainier National Park, you drive down Highway 7, go through Eatonville. So the two big brown clusters in the middle of the screen were former Weyerhaeuser timberland, and they were sold off between about 2003 and 2007 in 20 and 40 acre kind of residential home site parcels. And there's some reasons that this is happening. One, you got a lot of new people moving to the region. Two, it can be easier in some ways to build out here than it is to build within the urban growth boundary. A lot of times it can be easier to get a building permit. The water can be easier to get. You just drop a well in the ground, and wells like that are exempt from permits. So this got divided up. It got sold out. And so the questions to ask are, what impact does that have on Puget Sound? There's a lot more road surface that goes into that forest, decreasing the forest's ability to absorb rainwater runoff. And this is just one example of that type of conversion that's happened around the sound. The middle of the screen is a parcel that just went up for sale in August. It's about 750 acres, zoned at 10-acre lots. And so the concern is that, that's sort of the trajectory that these types of parcels are on, and that there are impacts on Puget Sound, the local waterways, and what can we do about that. So this is just some numbers from the plan. I think the point to make with this slide is that this bottom arrow, there's a zero on forest and farm. That means that the plan, the growth management plan, does not actually have a number. It says that we are going to have no growth in our farm and forest land. And there actually is growth happening there. So what can we do? What can we do to address that? More of the context in terms of why the growth coming to the region is giving us these challenges. So the gray is designated urban area in the central Puget Sound region. The colors, and if you were close enough to the map, you'd see basically a whole series of dots here. There's red dots and black dots. And the red dots are development potential, so essentially the right to build a house or a dwelling unit on a piece of property. And the black dots are existing. You see about, in these three counties, about 100,000 potential houses, essentially. And that's spread across the rural lands, which are sort of the band of more sort of densely dotted foothills close to the urban areas. And then there's fewer dots out on the forest lands that are here west of Mount Rainier and sort of elsewhere up the Cascade foothills. But the point being, there's essentially places where we want to really minimize development because they have a lot of impacts on Puget Sound, climate, et cetera. But there's the legal ability to go out and develop. And so how do we mesh those sort of two realities together? Just a little bit more eye candy. This is a depiction of current land use. If we're looking out to 2030 or sort of the near-term planning horizon, I'm going to go back to this. So if you look out to 2030, things don't change that much, but if you're going out 100 years, the numbers get really big, and if we don't have sort of new strategies to address the fact that there is development potential out there and the fact that the growth management boundaries can change, then you get a scenario that looks like this. So we're aiming in 100 years to have something much more within our built footprint. So those are the things that kind of keep us awake at night at Cascade Land Conservancy and the other folks in the planning community and the conservation community, is that, here's this huge volume of growth that's coming to the region. What can we do? What can we do recognizing that there are property rights associated with that development potential that's in the lands that we want to conserve? What are the strategies to deal with that? So that's where the Cascade Agenda comes in. And back in 2005, we brought together a whole range of interest groups and concerned citizens and experts from scientific and planning fields, government leaders, elected officials, and had a conversation called the Cascade Dialogues. It lasted for about a year. And the result was these goals. 1.3 million acres of farms, forest, parks, and habitat, conserving 1.3 million acres. And then the kind of the aha moment, which I think seems more obvious now, but at the time was a big revelation for a land trust that had really been focused on conservation, was that if you're going to conserve this scale of the landscape, you really need to make cities be a magnet for that growth that's coming to the region. So you need to have some place that's going to attract people, not just lands that are conserved and protected from development. So those are the two pieces of the Cascade Agenda. It's about looking out 100 years, well beyond the current planning framework, linking these three elements of sustainability, the strong economy in terms of working lands conservation, promoting livable communities, and then the environment side of that three-legged stool that I think we often hear referred to in terms of sustainability. This, again, is just a list of the folks that were engaged in the Cascade Dialogues. So big numbers in terms of just the number of folks who were engaged in all those discussions. The goals break down from that 1.3 million acres. So it's about 700,000 acres of working forest land, which is the light green on the map, if that shows up relatively well. About 300,000 acres of working farms. And then the remaining 250,000 acres of parks, habitat, and waters. Just to distinguish, again, between, I think, the way that Cascade Land Conservancy had been doing business and the way that the Cascade Agenda framed our business going into the future, this is your traditional conservation model. You got a piece of property out there that is important for one reason or another, whether it's great timber-growing soil or it's really important owl habitat. Fill in your reason. We want to conserve it. You go out, you raise the money, you buy the land, and then you have the land, but then you got to start the whole process all over again. And looking across the landscape and the scale of conservation we wanted to achieve, it was pretty obvious in these conversations that we need to do something different. So this is an example of how the different model works. You get the land for $10 million. You sell development rights. I'll talk about transfer development rights in a little bit. Sell those back for $8 million. You actually, as a conserved property, cut some of the trees down in a sustainable way. And then you got money back in the bank to go do it all again. And it's a revolving fund that sustains itself and allows you to get these tools up to scale. So this is the Cascade Agenda approach. It's how can we use incentives and markets? How can we scale up conservation so that it's going to get to the number of acres that that we want? So back of the envelope calculation, 1.3 million acres is somewhere in the $7 or $8 billion of conservation value range. And we break down our tools in the Cascade Agenda in kind of three buckets: value-added conservation tools, new financing resources, aligning market and regulatory forces. Just to give a couple examples of these, value-added conservation can be something like a conservation development. We've been involved in at least one of these projects where you have a project that is maybe ready to proceed forward. There's a certain amount of development potential on the land. We help come in, cluster that development on a more dense footprint, conserve part of it, and then the development is essentially paying for the conservation that happens. New financing resource. Yeah, go ahead. Right.
How much more land do you have to buy to make up for what you sold and developed?
So I'll talk about transfer development rights in a little bit. So the question was if you're selling development rights off of land, then if I can read into your question a little bit, I think you're saying, do those development rights then go develop some other piece of land that you might have wanted to conserve? Is that kind of your question?
Actually, well, actually I have a
you're saying is that you, in the parcel of land that you bought, you could sell part of that land for development proper.
That's part of how it can happen, and probably not the preferred way for it to happen. I gave that example because we did do that once out near, it's sort of north of Snoqualmie Ridge. There was about 300 acres. They were going to develop somewhere around 200 or 250 of it, and we basically brokered a deal so that the footprint of that was only about 40 acres, and then you could have a 200-acre preserve out of it. The preferred system in terms of selling development rights is selling a development right off of the property into an urban area. So you might have a 1,000-acre working forest, and again, I'll talk about TDR in a little bit, and maybe it'll make more sense then, but you sell that development potential, nothing happens to that 1,000 acres, there's a permanent easement on that, and then you use those, exercise those development rights in an urban area. Yeah. So new financing, I think, refers to the fact that if you have a working landscape, there's revenue coming off of that. How can we use that revenue to conserve? So there's a tool that I'll talk about a little bit later called community forestry bonds, which is essentially a revenue bond based on working timberland that allows you to permanently conserve a working forest. Aligning market and regulatory forces is things like getting ecosystem markets up and running so that there's an incentive for landowners to practice conservation on their property, things like carbon markets that might be an incentive for a landowner to avoid development. So this is just kind of giving you a sense for the, and I'll talk about some of those examples that I mentioned in a little bit more detail, but just giving you a sense for the scale of the effort and the types of ideas. Actually, let's see. So again, there's a whole sort of laundry list of strategies that falls within the Cascade agenda, from the urban side to new financing resources, transfer development rights. This is to not necessarily be read, but just impress you because it's a big, long list of things. So let me now just talk a little bit about, and thanks for the question. Feel free to ask stuff as we're going along and jump in. So I'm going to talk about a few specific strategies and what the latest is that's happening with them at the state level. There's one bill, as I mentioned, that's in Congress right now, and give you guys sort of what's hot off the press in terms of actually turning some of these ideas into reality. So starting with transfer of development rights, the quick 101 primer on transfer of development rights is that a development right that's associated with a property can be severed from that property ownership in just the way that a water right or a mineral right can be severed. So you might have someone who owns a piece of property and they find out that a mining company or the government actually owns the, you know, coal that's under their ground. You can be a farmer and you can sell water rights or some other kind of landowner. In the same way, there are programs in place where essentially you can sell your right to develop. So you might have a cornfield down by Mount Rainier in the Puyallup Valley, and you got 20 acres. The zoning is one unit per 5 acres, so that means you have 4 development rights. Pierce County just passed a program that we worked with them on that allows that farmer to sell that development potential to someone else within the urban growth boundary who wants to build above their currently allowed zoning ordinance. So that's how sort of it works on the landowner side, is that you can sell your development potential, you have a permanent easement that's placed on the property, so then you are giving up in perpetuity, so forever, your ability to develop, but you're also getting the cash value of that development potential. And then on the buyer side, this would be a developer who is wanting to build a project that's in a zone that only allows, say, a house per 4 acres, and they'd like to go to a house per 8 acres, or 4 houses per acre, and they'd like to go to 8 houses per acre or 10 houses per acre, and they can buy that development potential to get that zoning variance, essentially. So money goes to the farmer, development rights go into the urban area. it's a market-based transaction. It's not public funds that are going into paying for the conservation. And it kind of goes back to this cascade agenda model of the revolving fund that I showed in the earlier image. So that's the concept. One of the big challenges with it is that in order to make it work for cities, cities have participated in the creation of the growth management plan. There's folks that are looking at the numbers, people coming to the region saying, where are they all going to go? Okay, and then it basically gets divided up. This city is going to shoot for this target. This city is going to shoot for that target. And then a lot of planning happens around that. If you're accepting another 100,000 people, then this sort of amount of infrastructure money comes along with it. Well, so if you're changing that by having some of the growth that was going into rural area or outside the city, if you're transferring that into the city, then it essentially puts new demands on the infrastructure that's in a city. It's more kids going to the schools. It's more people walking down the street on the sidewalks. It's more people needing to hook up to water, et cetera. So this is basically what the city's input has been as we've promoted these programs is, you know, hey, we're all for saving farmland, but you guys got to help us out with the infrastructure. So the idea is to link infrastructure money to transfer development rights receiving areas, which essentially says, and let me go into the sort of specifics of this concept. It essentially says we're going to give you access to new money if you participate in this transfer development rights receiving system. So has anyone heard the term tax increment financing before? It's basically a concept that has been around for a little while. Washington State is one of two or three states in the nation that actually does not allow this. And there's some kind of weird constitutional reasons why folks have been nervous to try and push it in the past. But we've slowly been making our way towards enabling this tool. And basically what it says, this graph over on the right, what it essentially says is, okay, we can build new infrastructure that will help bring in development, but we don't have the money right now to build the infrastructure to bring the new development in. So how about we just bet that the new development will come in if we build it, if we build this infrastructure, and then we use the new property taxes that are going to come as a result of that development to sort of pay for the upfront infrastructure investment. So it's essentially just like bonding. You have a revenue stream. You have new development that's coming into an area. You are predicting that it's going to come in at a certain rate. And then you go out and you borrow a bunch of money upfront and say, this development's going to come in at this rate. Let's build the infrastructure now, and then that'll be a way of attracting the growth. So, that's the basic concept. Your base property taxes basically stay the same for the city. This new increment that builds as the new development comes in is what you're able to use for the infrastructure funding. And then once the infrastructure is built, you have more development in the places that you want it, and then the city gets more property taxes. So this is basically the concept that we're running right now. Our legislative coordinator is down in Olympia this afternoon. We're getting bill sponsors on board. And just to sort of pause for a minute and draw the line from here all the way back to Puget Sound. So again, this is transfer development rights can only work according to the cities if we get them some infrastructure money up front. If we're able to pass this bill, it'll mean that infrastructure money is made available to cities that do transfer development rights. Then there'll be receiving areas. Then there'll be a place for the forest land, farmland, and rural land owners to sell their development potential. Then we'll get permanent conservation in the places we want to conserve. And then we won't have as much damage to Puget Sound. So that's the chain reaction back to what we're really talking about here today, which is this sort of upland strategy to protecting and restoring Puget Sound. This is just a little bit more of the nitty-gritty. It gets complicated when you talk about how does a city commit to accepting development rights? Like, when do they get the money through this infrastructure financing tool? So we've got this whole kind of sequencing worked out that that we're getting the cities to buy into, and that's the build that we're running right now. So I will gloss over that for now. Okay. So that's sort of like hot item number one is transfer development rights, what we're doing to actually make it work. Hot item number two is there's only a demand in the cities for a pretty small fraction of these development rights. And there's about 100,000 that are out there total in these three counties. And there may, and I'm always hesitant to throw out numbers because these are totally rough, and if you guys promise not to repeat them, then I'll feel comfortable saying them, but anywhere from like 10 to 15 to maybe 20,000 development rights is the demand in the urban area, is sort of the sponge receiving capacity of the urban area to transfer these development rights. And that's looking at, you know, how much growth is going there, what's the sort of buildable lands capacity. Anyway, bottom line is TDR is not going to solve the problem on its own. So we need other strategies. And one of the other strategies that's out there is essentially how can we have receiving areas in the rural zone. So again, going back to the development rights kind of dot map that I showed earlier, this is basically the legal option for this little cartoon world that is representative of some of the rural areas. Legal option is building out in these 5, 10, and 20 acre lots. If you want to, and this is really important. I mean, this is a lot of landowners who have real financial value in their ability to develop, and this is how they're allowed right now to exercise that value. So the idea is, in addition to focusing as much of the development potential through TDR into urban areas, let's make some really small, very specifically located so they don't have impact on key watersheds, et cetera, but small, compact receiving areas in rural lands as well to give somewhere else for that development potential to go instead of spreading across the landscape. So in a situation like this, Carnation Forest, we had actually talked to this landowner about this idea. There was a bill that did not pass, so the tool was not made available to the landowner. If you were to have some alternative other than what we showed earlier in terms of these 10-acre lots, you could really condense things down to just a small little portion of the property. And then in terms of the lands where you're transferring the development from, so the forest lands have 80-acre zoning, so you only have one house per 80 acres allowed. So if you're transferring a couple hundred of those development rights, then you're permanently conserving those lands where you're transferring it from, which adds up to like thousands of acres of permanently conserved land just by having this small cluster. So we're looking at 2011 legislative session for that idea. So that's transfer development rights into urban areas, this idea of creating rural receiving areas as well. And just a couple other of sort of the latest things that we're working on. Environmental markets, which is basically the ability to buy and sell credits, whether it's for water quality or habitat or wetlands. And there's a variety of markets that are enabled right now. The Puget Sound Partnership is working with the Department of Ecology to do an assessment, a characterization of the watersheds in Puget Sound. It's supposed to be done right about now, and I owe somebody a phone call to try and figure that out, whether it is done. But the idea is to designate areas of protection, restoration, development, then link this together so that you could basically sell a habitat credit or a wetland credit in a sort of a similar way that transfer of development rights works to enable protection in these sort of key designated areas. I just like this picture. That's most main reason why I showed the slide. The existing wetland mitigation rules are not working very well. And that's one of the big reasons why environmental markets are important. On-site mitigation basically means you go out and build a freeway interchange, and in the past, you dig a big pit next to the freeway interchange you just built over a wetland, and the pit's about the same size as the wetland you just paved over, and you fill the pit up with water, and you like plant some reeds around it, and you call that a pretty fair trade-off. Across the landscape, that hasn't worked out too well, and so the idea is that instead of having Department of Transportation spend money on a pit next to the interchange, why not put that money into restoring something that's really going to have an ecological value in the long run? So that's the basic idea of having these better ecosystem market trades up and running. The meeting I'm going to right after this is on in-lieu fee program for Puget Sound, which is just that idea. It's instead of sort of this direct on-site mitigation, the developer just pays into a fund. That fund then goes and gets projects that have a lot more bang for the buck. Let's see. So I think I just have a couple more things to mention, and then I would love to have questions from folks if there are any. This picture is a map that we made for the press release that we had back this summer around the introduction of federal legislation that would enable community forestry bonds. And I mentioned this briefly earlier. The basic concept is that you have a working forest. It produces revenue. Let's give nonprofits the ability to issue tax-exempt debt. So go out and borrow a bunch of money, tax-exempt, buy a piece of working forest land, and then sustainably harvest that working forest to pay the money back. Over 30 or 40 years, once you have that money paid back, that forest is owned by the community, can be managed for ongoing revenue from that timber harvest, can be managed for, you know, in 30 years, if climate is our top priority, carbon sequestration, can be managed for habitat, water supply, etc. So it's a bill, there's a tax law tweak right now that needs to happen in order for that to be a possible tool to use. So it's in Congress. And if anyone knows Senator Max Baucus from Montana, please talk to me afterwards, because we really need to get him on board. There was a question.
When you say owned by the community, do you mean like by the county or the city? Is it a city sort of like park land?
So the question was, when I say owned by the community, actually when I say owned by the community, in the bill it specifies that there's a particular composition of a qualified buying entity that would be able to use these. And the board of directors for the nonprofit that would qualify has to be some elected officials, some industry representatives, some, I think, kind of conservation nonprofit, some other. So it really is kind of this community board of directors that would own the forest, and it would probably be entities specifically formed to purchase individual pieces of land. Yeah. And then let's see these two. Okay, yeah, I'll just mention this. So this was at the end of last year. We just put together some of the successes that we've had. There's been transfer development rights legislation in 2007, 2009. We're hoping again either this year in 2011 to really make this tool work. We did get some funding for initial purchases of development rights, and so we did that over this past year, and we're working to sell those rights back into receiving areas. I didn't talk very much, really at all, actually, about the Cascade Agenda Cities program. I just sort of mentioned that the urban side is an important part of the equation. And we have 16 cities signed up in this program that essentially is a, this is how you do smart growth kind of technical assistance and membership program for cities in the region. Got 20,000 volunteers to restoration sites. And I was going to mention just one more thing, which is, in addition to the Cascade Agenda, we're doing a similar effort on the Olympic Peninsula called the Olympic Agenda, which is to have another conversation. What is, what's going to happen in terms of growth on the peninsula? How can we look at sustainable land use management and conservation on the peninsula? So would love to have questions on any of that. Yeah, go ahead, Reed.
So, I think the fact that people want to live outside the city, they want
Yeah. Yeah, so the question was, I talked a lot about conserving lands. Well, these can be really fantastic places to live, and people often want to live out there. It's part of the driver for development happening out there. So how do we deal with that fact? I guess two pieces. So one, part of the reason for really pushing for these sort of market-based approaches is that they are voluntary from a landowner's perspective. So you don't have to sell your development rights, and not everyone will for exactly that reason. They may want to develop. There might be somebody else who wants to buy the property from them and develop there. But if they want to conserve their property, the idea is that let's give them some option to do so without just regulating the development rights out of existence and saying you can't do it. So there will be continued development in the rural areas, and there will be, I think, outlet for that demand. But hopefully we'll be able to, you know, shift as much of that into ecologically benign development forms and within our existing footprint as we can. Yeah.
Could you go back to about your eighth slide from the beginning?
Sure.
And you had a list of interest groups, like public officials.
Yeah. Let's see. Oh, yeah. Okay. This one. Let's see. How do I? Was this one you were thinking of? Let's see. It's from current slide.
Yeah.
Okay. So these were folks that we talked to in the Cascade Agenda process, just sort of the buckets, if you will, electeds, experts from the university. Did you have a specific question about it, or do you just want to see it? Okay, great.
Have you seen any legislation or as part of your agenda, you guys have any recommendations on sort of bridging the gap between time frame of GMA planning and sort of the more long-term 100-year climate change?
Yeah, so the question is, how do you bridge the gap between the sort of shorter-term Growth Management Act planning timeframes, updates to comprehensive plans, that kind of thing, and looking out 100 years? That's a good question. So just a couple examples are, really these tools need to be incorporated into the short-term stuff. So we worked with Pierce County to get an ordinance passed that enables transfer of development rights, and then sort of on an ongoing basis, it's part of their planning that they're doing. Same thing in Kittitas County over on the east side of the mountains in Ellensburg. Another example is that this map that I showed, I got a lot of slides here. There was the watershed characterization slide that I showed of sort of like the green, yellow, and red areas designated either for protection or restoration and development. So that's happening all across the Sound, and the idea is to take that characterization framework and really build it into the Shoreline Master Program updates and the county comprehensive plans, so that local governments, because really the land use decisions are made at the local level, which is part of the challenge. You got to coordinate it all across the Sound. So, yeah, yes is the answer to how are we doing that. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, have you considered anything that's somewhat radical, like maybe there should not be a right to pollute, and development is going to some. And so the thing is that some ways to say if you're going to develop, you can't pollute.
Right. Yeah, so the question was how about some sort of law that says if you're going to develop, then you can't pollute along with that development. And I think that there's a few, that would be, I guess I have a few thoughts on that. One, it might be tough to get that law passed just in terms of implementation, but the concept is definitely something that we're pursuing, which is to say, you know, there's impacts associated with the development, and how can you bring to bear either other options for someone to not develop and conserve their property, or if they are going to develop, how do you do it in a way that has a lot less impact? So, you know, that is the, I think, the engine behind how can you cluster development much more densely so that instead of spreading it out and sort of fragmenting the habitat, you're having it on a footprint and in a place that you've studied and you said, okay, the groundwater infiltration here is the best we possibly have for development. And so how can you make it as ecologically benign as you can?
Okay, one more question.
Let's see. Go ahead. Yes, they did. So the question was about the Boy Scouts and a piece of conservation property that now, so there was a recent, I don't think that was here. I thought that was, okay. There was a, okay, let's see.
Well, all right, let me ask a question differently. It seems to me very difficult to explain to people if they are donating a piece of land that they valued as, let's say, partially farmed, partially forested, mm-hmm. and they donate it, and then their heirs see that the land isn't conserved, that some of it is used for logging, and some of it is sold off for development, and they're saying, you know, our grandparents donated that land to you, mm-hmm. and they got it because they wanted
right.
it.
Right.
The answer is, yeah, we'll use the money better somewhere else.
Right.
It seems like a very difficult way to explain to people what to do.
Yeah, I totally agree. So part of the problem, I think, with those transactions is that there was not a permanent conservation easement that was put on the property that was donated to the Boy Scouts. So they retained the development rights for that property. And I think people assume that because they're donating the land to the Boy Scouts that it's going to stay, you know, a land where you can go hike and build campfires. But they still had the legal right to build and do whatever they want. Even, you know, the land was sort of donated in fee, so that's part of the issue. And there's been other properties that we worked on. There's the Hidden Valley camp out near Carnation that we did put a conservation easement on, so that can't happen. Yeah.
Thanks very much, Dan.
What did you study here? I see.